From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The U.S. Supreme Court's refusing to weigh in on an Indiana law banning abortions of fetuses diagnosed with Down syndrome. The court will wait for multiple district judges to rule. We'll look at what the high court's action signals about its willingness to consider abortion bans. On a lighter note, we'll talk with the winner of the paper airplane flying competition. He's from Long Beach. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Hope you had a superb Memorial Day weekend. Yesterday, remembering those who sacrificed their lives in military service, of course. And for many people, a chance to get out of town, the unofficial start of summer. However you observe the 3 days, we appreciate your being back with us today on Air Talk. A little bit later this hour, we'll talk with a Long Beach man who won the paper airplane flying competition. There are three categories. You might not have known that about the international competition. His went the farthest, and he's going to share with us his special techniques. You can even try them at home. But first, we begin with the U.S. Supreme Court and its decision on an Indiana abortion restriction law that it will not take up what is the centerpiece of that restriction. The abortion law in Indiana, signed by then-Governor Mike Pence back in 2016, said that a fetus could not be aborted for the reason that Down syndrome had been diagnosed. Now, what the high court's done is put this back into a lower court arena, so they will ultimately determine whether that stands or not. With us to talk about the politics of abortion in this specific Supreme Court case is UCLA professor of political science and Chicano studies, Matt Barreto. He's also co-founder of the research and polling firm Latino Decisions. Matt, good morning.
Thank you, Larry. It's good to be back.
Also with us, Lonnie Chen, the Stanford's Hoover Institution research fellow there and an advisor for both the Rubio and Romney presidential campaigns. Lonnie, good to have you with us again.
Good morning, Larry. Good to be with you.
Let's start with this Supreme Court. Lonnie, your thoughts about what this might say about the high court deciding not to take on the restriction related to this particular Indiana law.
Well, it's an interesting decision, Larry, because I think it demonstrates a little bit of caution in terms of how the high court is going to approach this issue. Obviously, there are very deeply held beliefs on this issue, and the court recognizes that. In some ways, by sidestepping the crucial questions regarding abortion rights in this case, what they've done is signaled a pathway that may be a more careful pathway than supporters of abortion certainly had feared. I think the question is down the road how the court will evaluate the question. Obviously, there will be further case law that will come before the court on this question. And so the issue is going to be when and if they take up the question. Justice Thomas, in his concurrence, gives some indication that it might happen down the road when a different set of facts presents itself or when two circuit courts conflict, which is when the Supreme Court oftentimes will choose to step in when there's a disagreement between circuits about how to handle a particular question of law. And so I suppose we're all in wait and see mode in terms of what will happen. But it is interesting that they did choose in this case to decline to address some of the thornier issues.
And we should also mention that the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals has stayed the implementation of this law. Judge there ruling that this did run afoul of the Roe v. Wade decision. But again, other districts are expected to also take this on. Matt, your thoughts about how the high court decided to punt on this?
Yeah, I think I mostly agree with Lonnie on this, that this is sort of a signal that the justices are not overly eager to jump into the abortion fight. It means they're inclined to move slowly and cautiously on abortion's rights issues. And they did unanimously agree to let this lower court ruling stand that you just mentioned. So the Seventh Circuit federal judge had struck down the Indiana law. And when the judge did that, referenced specifically that this violated the Roe v. Wade interpretation of the Constitution. And so they had a chance to weigh in on this. If they really wanted to, they could have, and they decided not to. It's also important to note that the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals didn't actually issue a full ruling because I believe they deadlocked 4-4 on when it came to the full Court of Appeals. And so I think they are still waiting for more districts and other judges to weigh in on this. And when there is that conflict, you may see it come up. But it's important to remember that they had a chance. They could have taken this up. They could have said, we're going to jump in on this, and they decided not to. So I think that gives us a little bit of tea leaves that they're not anxious to weigh in on this and overturn something as consequential as Roe v. Wade.
Also wanted to ask you, Matt, about the Trump administration saying that it's not going to be enforcing protections for transgender patients under the Affordable Care Act. The Obama administration had extended those protections. It's not specifically addressed in the ACA legislation. So your thoughts, you know, California does have specific protections about transgender employees and patients here with civil rights protections extended to that classification. But your thoughts on where this might lead in terms of court challenges?
Well, I think there certainly is going to be a court challenge when this HHS rule is rolled out and has the full effect of the weight of the executive branch. As you said, this was not part of the ACA directly. It was a 2016 a memorandum from the Obama administration to extend gender identity as part of patients' rights under discrimination of, quote, on the basis of sex. So that was classified as part of that, and there could not be discrimination. Because that was an executive order, now Trump has come back and through his HHS has said, we want to rescind that. We no longer believe that gender identity is part of that. And I think the way that this plays out is that it is going to look like a part of the Trump administration's larger efforts to weaken and roll back Obamacare, really in its entirety. And I don't think that's a good play for them in 2020, given how strong an issue healthcare access was in 2018. I think even for people who may not be directly adjacent to the transgender community, they see this as just another attempt to make it harder for people to get access to healthcare, to get access to insurance and treatment. And it's going to be easy for the Democrats to make that a pitch because the DOJ has said they're going to stop defending Obamacare because Trump has made other comments about repealing Obamacare. This is not an issue that's a winner for the Republicans, so it's surprising that they're pushing on this.
Lottie, I was sort of seeing this as opposed to an ACA specific, even though it is specifically about the ACA, as more about social conservative skepticism about there being such a thing as transgender, you being an actual physical thing, and that this is the administration playing to that. How do you see it?
Yeah, I think there's a couple different angles here, Larry. I absolutely think that the analysis with respect to the ACA makes sense. And I think it's an interesting question about how Republicans will play those healthcare issues generally as we get toward 2020. But I do think that there is an effort here, to your point, Larry, to galvanize and to continue to energize part of the president's base that he believes is politically important and valuable to his reelection campaign next year. And there's no question that for incumbent presidents, motivating and energizing the political base is an important strategy. I do think that certainly speaking to some of these issues in the way the president has would be appealing to elements of that base. And so I think as a political play, one might understand it better. But yes, I think there's both an effort to appeal to social conservatives, but also potentially to continue to drive a particular message with respect to the ACA, which, you know, I think had mixed results, probably bad results in 2018, and we'll see what happens ahead.
We're talking with our political analyst, Lonnie Chen, from whom you just heard, Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He's advised the Rubio and Romney presidential campaigns. Matt Barreto, UCLA professor of political science and Chicano studies, co-founded Latino Decisions, which does research and polling on the Latino electorate. We're talking about the top political stories of the week. Lonnie, I also wanted to ask you about the Justice Department and its investigation into surveillance of the Trump campaign 2016 during the general election. This is something the president had requested. Attorney General Bill Barr is undertaking, and the president giving Barr the latitude to make public classified material here. And I've been seeing all kinds of concerns from intelligence professionals about the unmasking of that material and whether, you know, and the president of an attorney general being in the position to do that. Your thoughts about this?
Well, yeah, first of all, it is a significant delegation of authority to the attorney general. I think that the argument from the White House is, look, we are giving to the attorney general the ability to make public those documents he sees fit. I think they pitch it in terms of transparency. I think you've heard a lot of people representing the president and the administration say, look, this is an opportunity for there to be transparency independent of the White House. Now, whether one believes that or not probably depends largely on their view of the president. In terms of the actual investigation into what happened during the 2016 campaign and allegations that the Trump campaign was surveilled, this goes back to the conversation we were having a little bit earlier, Larry, about what the conservative base is looking for at this point in time. And I think there is a tremendous amount of agitation within conservative communities about investigating the degree to which there was surveillance, or as some, including the attorney general, have called it, spying on the Trump campaign. I think that is an effort both to satisfy those constituencies, but also, frankly, to satisfy the president, who himself has been calling for this investigation for some time. So it is, again, I hate to say it, it all does come back to politics at some level. And this is an example of where there's an effort to engage parts of the president's base that are going to welcome this announcement and indeed be very supportive of it.
Matt, how do you see this? And do you think it is a dangerous precedent for Barr to have this latitude?
Well, first of all, I think it is a dangerous precedent. I mean, the CIA is not used to working for the attorney general on determining what is classified and what is not. So this is going to look like political meddling to some. And the CIA does not like to release sources and confidential information. And typically they have not had to go through the purview of the attorney general to allow the attorney general to decide what is classified and what is not. So on that respect, I think it could create a dangerous precedent. You know, to the larger point, I don't think this is a base issue. I mean, I agree with Lonnie on the previous point that perhaps something related to social conservatism and transgender rights and certainly ACA. But I don't see the Trump base really wanting to go back and relitigate whether or not the Obama FBI had, intercepted or listened to calls from the Trump campaign. If anything, this could potentially backfire, because if there is a transparency claim here, and if there is a claim of just open up the records and let everyone see what's happening, you know, there's a reason that people were worried in 2016 about the Trump campaign, and that's because they had extremely close relations, whether it was through Trump himself or through his surrogates, to Russia. And so if there is, in fact, transparency, and if, in fact, these different agencies are allowed to bring information to light, then it could backfire in terms of what information exactly comes out. Now, if they're not, then the larger problem here is with the selective release of information. If you control which information the public gets to see and you only show them small pieces that help your cause, it's going to eventually have the effect of looking more like a cover-up. So while some in the Trump base may, you know, feel vindicated by this supposed report that Barr's going to oversee, it's only going to feed the fuel of the fire of the left of saying, this is a cover-up. We don't believe this. You're not releasing the Mueller report. You're not releasing this other information. So I don't see this as a potential winner, and I just don't see it as a base issue on the right.
All right. We're talking with Professor Matt Barreto of UCLA, Lonnie Chen of Stanford's Hoover Institution. We had back and forth last week between House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and President Trump, in which each of them questioned the other's fitness.
The president again stormed out. I think what? First, pound the table, walk out the door. What? And now this time, another temper tantrum. Again, I pray for the President of the United States. I wish that his family or his administration or his staff would have an intervention for the good of the country.
So I walked into the cabinet room. You had the group, Crying Chuck, Crazy Nancy. I tell you what, I've been watching her, and I have been watching her for a long period of time. She's not the same person. She's lost it.
So back and forth, the president and the House Speaker will talk about what seems to be an unprecedented characterization of the other national leader's state of mind. We'll continue in 1 minute on Air Talk. It's time for our weekly political analysis, doing it Tuesday today because of yesterday's Memorial Day holiday. And we're joined by Matt Barreto of UCLA, political scientist Lonnie Chen of Stanford's Hoover Institution, getting their perspectives on the top political news. Just before we break, I played the back-to-back clips of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and President Donald Trump questioning each other's mental fitness. Lonnie, I can't recall in my 3.5 decades of covering politics something comparable between two leaders like this. It seems to me highly corrosive, but what do you think?
Yeah, I can't recall anything quite like this either, and corrosive is certainly one way of describing it. I think it's all very unsightly, the back and forth, quite frankly. But this is the nature of the politics that we find ourselves in, and I think that to a certain degree, Larry, that neither side, neither the president nor Speaker Pelosi, would be doing this unless they felt that some element of the people who support them or people who are following politics didn't respond to it. And this is the same thing I say about negative advertising. People always wonder, well, why do campaigns always use negative advertising? When people say they don't like negative advertising, the answer is because it works to a certain degree. It tends to motivate people. And in the same way, this back and forth, I have to think, is to a certain degree responsive to to what people want or to what people want to see. I mean, they want to see out of Speaker Pelosi a toughness, and those who support President Trump, they probably like some of what he does. But I personally find both sides and this back and forth to be unsightly and unbecoming. And certainly the president bears a little more responsibility in my mind because he's the president. And we tend to expect the president to adhere to a higher standard. And I would hope that that's something that going forward he would do, although, we've now had a few years in office to see how the president tends to respond to these things.
Yeah, he just reflexively defends himself by attacking the person who said something negative about him. Matt, your thoughts on this from both perspectives?
Well, I think that it's wrong, first of all, to equate these two. What happened was that Speaker Pelosi had indicated that she believed that there was some attempt to cover up malfeasance on the part of the president, and he didn't like that word. She didn't call him any names at the outset or anything like that, and that's what ended up blowing up this meeting, that he went into the meeting and he just lost his cool, and he didn't even want to meet with Pelosi and Schumer because he was so upset that they had said this word cover-up. And so from there, it just sort of spiraled out of control. And you have the president really is the one who is obsessed over this because he's bringing it up at speeches, whether he's supposed to be talking about his bailout for farmers or whether he's supposed to be in Japan talking about security issues in the Korean Peninsula. He's bringing this up, saying to reporters in front of other people, hey, did you hear what Nancy said about me? Almost like he's a little kid, trying to start a fight on a playground. And I think that's the part that is the most unsettling. Certainly, we would all like to move past this sort of name calling. But the name calling has really only, even in the clip that you played, it's only been one sided. It's the president calling her Crazy Nancy and these other sorts of names.
But Matt, she said she thought an intervention was called for by his family. These very strong words indicating that there's something seriously wrong with him mentally, that the family needs to intervene. You don't think that crosses a line?
Well, I don't know if she's got the, psychological training or whatever you would need to make that assessment. But I think a lot of other people have wondered that same question out loud in terms of why is the president so, hot and cold and go from one issue to the next? And why is he so obsessively concerned with defending himself and his name and his brand and these sorts of things, oftentimes above issues that are affecting the country. And so certainly that's not her area to weigh in on. And, you know, a little bit of what Lonnie said is right, that she's projecting an air of toughness. And there are those on the left who are calling for the president's impeachment and calling for tougher investigations against the president. So some of that is political posturing. But, you know, it's nothing that other trained professionals have not suggested out loud as well.
Right. Well, let's speaking of Nancy Pelosi, there was a Fox Business clip that they showed, which had Nancy Pelosi, because of how it was edited, stammering her way through the news conference. So we're going to play this. This, by the way, is not the altered video that slowed her down to make her appear as though she was intoxicated or mentally impaired. This is another video that showed on Fox Business Network that was edited to make her sound somewhat incoherent.
We had a little took a little longer on the floor. The custody of the border, Everyone, he started making, sending signals. The U.S., Mexico, Canada. If that's not the accurate category, some people call it AFTA NAFTA. Some call it NAFTA 2.0. We're working together to pass that.
This video was then tweeted out by President Trump after it aired on Fox Business News. And again, it was edited, taking discontinuity that she had in that interview, putting it all together to make the effect of that more concentrated. Lonnie Chan, you know, is this a fair thing to do? They're trying to highlight a lack of you know, through line in her speaking, but is that a fair way to do it?
Well, I mean, the notion of altering footage or altering what someone says, you know, I don't think that's fair. I don't think it's right to, you know, whether it's however it's done. I mean, to be clear, I think there is a lot of pernicious activity going on right now that is potentially even more scary in the sense that it takes someone's words and actually has them saying something completely different, the notion of deep fakes, which is something that's becoming more prevalent in parts of the internet, unfortunately. But no, I don't think it's fair to take someone's words and, you know, whether in fact her viewpoint was coherent or not, that's a separate conversation. But to alter one's speech or the cadence of one's speech or how someone's saying something in order to arrive at the same conclusion, that all strikes me as being problematic.
Well, and you can take just about anybody who speaks in public, pull out self-corrections, things like that, Matt, and make a person sound incoherent.
Isn't the first time we've seen this from the White House. They did the same thing with this, Jim Acosta, a CNN reporter, when there was this altercation supposedly in the press room. And we've seen other edited clips making the rounds. And so this is out of their playbook. And this is why the previous conversation we were having, you know, this is really a part of that, you know, in terms of equating Pelosi versus Trump. I mean, when Pelosi said that she is worried about his, you know, mental health, this is in direct response to that. This is, okay, let's get a video out there of her not looking so well, and then let's just, you know, go crazy tweeting it all over the place and making questions about her. And he continues to bring up in his speeches, oh, have you seen, you know, her health? So this is completely below the line. It should not be happening in politics. It should not be happening from the president of the United States. And whether Fox Business News put it out first or not, it is clearly coordinated. We know that the White House coordinates with Fox News all the time. And it's just laughable. And it's similar to the Joe Biden comments about siding with a dictator, Kim, over who has a low IQ. I mean, it's complete nonsense. And I hope that we can not give this the sort of credibility that it is getting in some circles.
You're talking about another fabricated quote. It was attributed to Joe Biden, correct?
Well, yes. And then this discussion that Sarah Sanders said, oh, you know, the president and dictator Kim had a discussion and they both agreed that Joe Biden has a very low IQ. I mean, this is like nonsense why they're talking about this on a foreign trip.
We're talking with Matt Barreto and Lonnie Chen. Do want to talk about where we stand with the candidates for the 2020 presidential race. Joe Biden continues to show a double-digit lead in most of the Democratic polls of the field and very challenging for others to try and break through. That despite the fact there's been criticism that Biden hasn't done very many events since announcing his campaign. Meanwhile, the numbers for Beto O'Rourke of Texas and Bill de Blasio of New York are absolutely horrid in the most recent polls that have come out. Matt, let's talk about the field. Biden, again, showing continued strength here after his announcement. This can all change when the debates come, of course. But your thoughts about how he continues to lead despite not keeping up the schedules of some of the other candidates?
Well, he's still getting a lot of earned media, even without his constant events. The other candidates are in a catch-up role. They're trying to get up to that same level of name recognition and being a household name that Joe Biden has and that Bernie Sanders has. So they're going to naturally be scheduling more events. But I think Joe Biden has been doing, I'd say, enough events and to keep his name out there. They seem to be fairly large. They get a lot of attention when he does them. But as you said, the debates are really going to be the first reset. So I wouldn't pay a lot of attention to the polling so far in terms of really where anyone is, because these debates are going to allow both the so-called top-tier candidates as well as those challengers who are coming up a chance to make their case. And the media spin and the narrative coming out of those could shoot somebody into that top tier. It could breathe some new life into a campaign. And at the same time, you could have candidates such as Biden or Sanders who are closer to the top. They may get some tough questions and they may not respond as well as the base may want them to. So I think the debates are going to be important. It's going to be the first sort of reset for the Democratic candidates, and we'll really get a chance to see how the different candidates position themselves and how the media and how social media reacts to those debates will be important.
And it just seems to me, Lonnie, this puts tremendous pressure on Beto O'Rourke, Bill de Blasio. If they don't come out and make very strong showings, which we know from the huge Republican field 4 years ago was extremely difficult. You got so many people, you get such limited time, very hard to distinguish yourself in a massive field, that those that are at the bottom of the polls are going to have a tough task.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, you've got a field of 20 some odd candidates, which is bigger than the Republican field, even in 2016. Primaries are about drawing very, very narrow distinctions on very small pieces of turf anyway. And so you're right. There is a tremendous amount of pressure. I mean, we think about lanes in a presidential primary competition. And so the question will be who will come out of each of these lanes. And the lanes are, as of now, still a little bit undefined. But it's fair to say that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and Beto O'Rourke and now Bill de Blasio may roughly be competing for a similar patch of voters. So those debates are going to be quite consequential. I think Joe Biden has the advantage, to your point about the criticism of him maybe not doing as many events. He has the advantage of name recognition, so he doesn't have to do as many events at this point in time and overexpose himself. So he will continue to be able to take that strategy even amidst the criticism, and the rest of these candidates occupying the progressive side of the field are going to have to battle it out.
Well, and you would think of in the case of a Biden or Sanders, that their default would be to play it quite conservatively in the debates to avoid making a mistake. For some of these, you know, lower tier candidates, they're going to have to take some risk, I would think, to really differentiate themselves and to build that name recognition. And so, Matt, I mean, is that how you'd be advising those that are well down in the polls? You just got to come out swinging?
I don't know that they need to take risks necessarily. They just need to make a very strong case for themselves. What are they offering the country that the other candidates are not? And I think that if they speak passionately and sincerely, I think that's what the American voters are looking for, really, that sincerity and authenticity in the candidate to know where they stand. You may not agree with them on every single issue, but can you trust them? And is that your voice speaking?
Gentlemen, I appreciate it very much. Good to talk with you as always. That's Matt Barreto, UCLA political scientist. He's professor at UCLA. Chicano studies also his specialty, and co-founder of Latino Decisions research and polling firm. From Stanford's Hoover Institution, research fellow Lonnie Chen, who advised both the Rubio and Romney presidential campaigns. Coming up, we'll talk about a new type of plastic which, if it can be put into mass production, could make a dramatic difference in the recyclability of waste. We'll continue in just a couple minutes after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in just a couple minutes, we'll talk with the Long Beach man who won the International Paper Airplane Flying Competition. His went the farthest of anybody. We'll find out about how he did it coming up in just a few minutes. But first, also in the field of science and technology, potentially new type of plastic that could significantly aid recyclability. As we talked about last week on Air Talk, the market for recycling plastics has gotten very constrained and very difficult because of the challenges of taking plastic out of consumer products and reusing it. Very difficult to get the percentages of recycling that we ideally would like. But what if a new type of plastic could help solve that problem? With us is Brett Helms, staff scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in Northern California. He directed the study. Brett, thank you so much for being with us.
Happy to be here with you.
So first, let's talk about the challenge of recyclability. Why is it so hard to pull plastic out of products and to reuse it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So plastics were really never designed to be recycled. We use them as barrier materials to hold our food, to, you know, move water through our pipes. You know, you're using them for their reliability. And so that's presented some challenges for the recycling industry, given how much we use plastics and how much plastics we make in the products today. So the types of plastics that we make in our group is intended as a counterpoint to the plastics that we've had for the last 100 years. And what we've done is essentially redesign their chemistry so that you can revert them back into the chemicals that they originally came from. And we can do that without them losing any of the quality in terms of the purity or manufacturability. And I think that's why a lot of people have gotten excited by the platform, particularly in the sustainability community, where alternatives to the existing plastics are fairly desirable.
Only about 10% of currently used plastics end up getting recycled. Explain to us the process. How do you, so let's say you take, you have a bottle or some other consumer product made out of this form of plastic you've developed in the laboratory. How do you separate that out in a cleaner way than current plastics?
Yeah, that's a great question. So once you manufacture plastics into a product, typically what goes into them in addition to just the plastic are things like, you know, pigments, because I want a specific color to my bottle. And maybe even there's a label on the plastic bottle as well that might be a different kind of plastic. So that complicates things because now we have to separate out the different plastics during the recycling process. But we also have to recover our plastic and separate out all of those pigments that might have been incorporated during the compounding step and eventually the manufacturing step. So what we do with our plastics is we embrace that, you know, product designers and brands are going to want those attributes to have their products be recognizable in the marketplace. But our chemistry allows you to essentially take that plastic bottle and put it into a simple solution of water with acid, and the polymer breaks down into its original bits and pieces, its original building blocks. Once it's in that stage, we are able to effectively separate out any of the additives that might have been added that includes plasticizers or any of the inks that might have been added, again, for color or appearance. And we can separate those out and isolate just our building blocks, and we can also give you those inks or any of those additives back at the same time. And so this process essentially closes the loop on recycling in a very circular way. And it does so uniquely. Again, none of the plastics in use today, maybe with the exception of polyethylene terephthalate, are able to capture the circularity at the chemical level, but also be able to offer any of these, you know, advantageous things like decoloration and decompounding at the recycling end.
Brett, if you were to try and put this into wide-scale usage, what would the cost be involved in retrofitting recycling plants for this, or would they have to be retrofit, or for manufacturers to substitute the current types of plastics used for this one developed in your lab?
Yeah, so most recycling facilities sort plastics on the basis of a chemical signature that's detectable by the infrared. And so our plastics actually have a unique chemical signature and might actually be able to be sorted as you would any of the other plastics at the level of the MRFs, the municipal recycling facilities. I think once they get sorted and binned appropriately, then those would go off to a separate entity for processing.
And would that have to be a new type of facility, or could current processing facilities do this?
Yeah, I think that current processing facilities could do this very simply because, you know, you would only need to have a vat that was capable of housing both the plastic intended to be recycled as well as this acidic water that is used to degrade the plastic material.
So it's so simple, you could potentially do this anywhere, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think a distributed approach to waste processing is something that we can look forward to in terms of how the recycling infrastructure is likely to evolve in this country. So I think that if we can, you know, put our plastic into such facilities or even advise on how such facilities might be constructed in the future, then I think it's a win-win situation for everyone.
We're talking with Brett Helms. He's the lead scientist on this study from the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, where he staffs scientists about a new form of plastic which can much more easily be separated from other ingredients into a consumer product made primarily of plastic, and then it could, in a very clean way, be recycled to future consumer products. Are there barriers to industry starting to use this plastic, and what are those, Brett?
Yeah, so since our initial disclosure of the platform technology, we've gotten a lot of interest from various sectors that use plastics, both in packaging for food and beverage, as well as in things as simple like plastic water bottles and shopping bags. And I think that you'll also continue to see, the textile industry where synthetic fibers are also integrated with natural fibers. And that also complicates recycling because now there's several types of materials present. So I think for apparel and footwear, packaging for food and beverage, I think that we're going to see a lot of interested partners to build here. I think that the main sort of next area that we need to focus on is how to tailor the plastic for these specific applications. And I think that that's going to come through these partnerships with these stakeholders in these various industries.
Have you named this new plastic?
The plastic is named PDKs. It's a kind of an organic chemistry name that is best simplified by the acronym.
Yeah, you need a sexier, consumer-friendly name for that.
Exactly, exactly. But the full name, if anyone is interested, is a polydiketoenamine. So,
of course. Yeah. All right. Hey, thank you for being with us talking about it. I know it's difficult to predict you know, how soon something like this could be adopted into consumer application. But it certainly sounds very promising while in your laboratory. Brett Helms, Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in the Bay Area, thank you very much. Appreciate your being with us.
Thanks, Larry.
You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we're going to find out about the engineering expertise of the farthest thrown paper airplane. The winner is from Long Beach, and he's with us. We'll be back in just 1 minute on Air Talk. In 2015, Long Beach resident Jay Carty was between classes on his college campus, so he started folding paper airplanes, first time since he was in elementary school. He then found out that Red Bull puts on paper wings, an international paper airplane competition, and he thought he'd give it a shot. He'd been a baseball player with a good throwing arm, thought maybe he'd have some potential here. Well, in fact, he had more than potential. He ended up winning the international competition in the distance category as he threw his paper airplane nearly 186 feet. Jake Hardy, Long Beach resident, joining us to talk about how he did it. Jake, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me today.
So there are people that compete at this that I know devote hours a day to getting just the right fold, to practicing the whole throwing approach. For you, it sounds like it was not that serious.
Yeah, it wasn't that serious at all. Like you said, I was just walking to class and saw a Red Bull competition. I was like, oh, I'll go watch. It's Red Bull. They got to have something cool there. I'll go watch some professional paper airplane people. And next thing I knew, I was in it. And then when I get to Austria, I knew how intense it was, really. People take hours a day to practice technique and throwing, and it's crazy.
And how much time did you spend in preparation? I guess you went to San Diego for the regional and then to Austria?
Correct, yeah. So I just went to San Diego. I was actually down there having dinner with a friend. And one of my friends texted me and said, hey, that Red Bull thing that you did like 4 years ago, there is down in San Diego. I'm like, all right, I'm going to go do it. I hadn't folded a paper airplane in 4 years.
I didn't realize that was just a lark doing the San Diego one. And then you did so well there, you were invited to Austria?
Correct, yeah. Setting the national record for the United States, they invited me to Austria to represent the U.S.
And that was Salzburg, so that's high elevation, right, to do the throw?
Correct, yeah. It was Salzburg, but it was all indoors. It was in Hangar 7, so it was nice. It was pretty cold outside, but it was nice indoors.
How many competitors were going at it?
In Salzburg, there was, I think, just under 180 from around the world.
Wow. Yeah. And you won it. And there are three categories, except beyond distance. What are the other two?
Correct. So distance, there's hang time, which they see how long they can get their airplane to stay in the air. And then aerobatics, which is like a freestyle, just music and a routine. That's crazy.
That's got to be fun to see the acrobatics.
That's really an art. Like I still laugh every time I think about paper airplanes, but this aerobatic stuff, it's crazy. They really make it an art what they can do with their stuff.
So you were telling me before we came on that to fold a paper airplane, the way to do it takes like 30 seconds. You mind doing it in front of me? And I'll try and do play by play as best I can on this. Okay, go right to it.
Definitely.
Okay, so, all right, he folds it just like you would as a kid, across to the opposite side of the paper. And so you've got a 45-degree angle. Looks like a sail of a sailboat at this point. And then he goes back across
this way
from the opposite direction. Yeah, and if you want to describe it as you do it, that's fine too. You probably do it better than me.
So kind of just two straight folds, like 45 degrees across the paper, just to get some marks on the paper.
Yeah, I see it. Okay. Yeah. So and once then, you got your marks.
Correct.
You're folding into the center mark, again, just like we would as kids.
Correct.
When we made this. Okay.
Just folding in.
Okay, so you're doing the wing on one side.
Uh-huh. And then from here, it gets a little bit tricky. You kind of...
Oh, see that? Okay, now you're getting slick because you're doing... I haven't seen a fold like that before that you did. Okay.
Right, yeah. So this isn't the typical floating plane, it's more of a dart.
All right.
And then from here, it's a lot of just folding in.
Okay.
A lot of folding. And if I was folding like to throw this, it would take a lot more precision for sure.
Okay. How long do, so if you're going to fold one of these to throw in a competition, how long would that take?
Probably a minute or so. Not too long, but it's just a lot more compressions, making sure all the folds are exactly perfect and whatnot.
And you're really leaning into those folds. You're putting a deep crease into that so it's tight.
Yeah.
All right. And then you end up, and I'm trying to see what you're doing with the nose. So looks like you're folding the tip in.
Yeah. You just want to get it all compressed so you have a hardish tip. This one isn't the best one.
That's right, but it is a little dart.
It's a little dart with a tip, and that's, you want most of the weight towards the front of the tip.
Okay.
Yeah.
You mind throwing it in the studio? We have not much distance, but I see. Wow, that is a dart.
Yeah, it really goes.
I see. Yeah, that is really, really fast. So how did you come up with the engineering for this?
To be honest, it's just a plane that I knew how to fold when I was younger. So actually for qualifying, it was very similar to that dart. That's what I qualified here in the U.S. And then once you get to Salzburg, they have qualifiers on Friday. And only the top 10 make the finals on Saturday. And I qualified with that. And then there was another guy from the U.S. who is a genius when it comes to origami. He knows. He has like his three own books. His name's Jason Merrill. Look him up on YouTube if you get the chance. He's crazy. But he said, hey, let me see the plane you're throwing. And he looked at my plane and he, for about 10, 15 seconds, got a new piece of paper and showed me how to fold pretty similar plane, but getting more weight towards the front. So it's all about the weight distribution. And that added about 15, 20 feet on the throw, which was very helpful.
And he was another competitor who helped you out?
Correct, yeah. So he was actually, he's going for the Guinness World Record. But the plane he flies, I guess, isn't great indoors. So once he didn't make the top 10, he goes, hey, like, let's get the U.S. a championship. So I was like, let's do it.
Great.
I love it. Yeah.
That's so is a sort of de facto teammate of yours, Jake Hardy, who won the distance competition in Red Bull's Paper Wings World Final Paper Airplane Contest, Salzburg, Austria, where he won the competition a little over a week ago, right?
Yeah, just about a week ago.
Yeah. So he's back in Southern California talking about his experience. Now, a lot of this, I'm sure, is your technique. You played baseball. So what is the approach? How rigid or flexible is your wrist when you throw it? Describe it.
Yeah, so going into it, I just had no technique. It was just a straight baseball throw, get a little crow hop and go. But then once I got there, I saw everybody like lining up their steps to like how far back they are from the line you can't cross. I was like, okay, this is really intense. And there was actually two other guys who kind of like coached me through it. They saw that I had a stronger arm. And then one guy, Addison, he's actually from Canada. He had competed in the past three world finals. He goes, hey, like, are you picking out, like, what angle do you throw at? I'm like, I don't know. I'm just throwing. And he said, well, pick a spot on the ceiling and aim for that and then make some adjustments on there. So he kind of helped me pick like about a 45 degree angle. And then another guy on the U.S. team, he goes, like, get your shoulders back just a little bit. And so I didn't have much technique, but there were some few guys who kind of coached me through and I guess added a little technique for sure. Setting your angle and then setting the angle of your shoulders too, just to get a little bit of air under it.
It's so nice that these other Americans in competition were so generous with their advice to help you have this extraordinary throw.
Yeah, it was definitely a big help. I mean, going into the competition, I knew I had a decent arm and could possibly walk away with a podium spot, but this coaching definitely helped a lot. Big shout out to Addison and Chester.
All right. Again, nearly 186 feet. So we're talking about nearly two-thirds of a football field that you threw your paper airplane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't even know that was possible, honestly. I used to be able to throw a paper airplane 10 feet, and that was awesome for me.
You have to go. You know, sometimes they throw them at baseball stadiums, Dodger Stadium. Yeah. Someone will, you have to go throw it from the upper deck and see if you reach the parking lot on the opposite side. Jake, thanks so much for coming in. A lot of fun. And I know you're going to do a little video for LAist for our website so people will be able to see you in action. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Long Beach's own Jake Hardy, another champion out of Long Beach. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Hey, it's just going to be me and you coming up later this hour. You and me, I guess I should say. We're going to be talking about the best beaches in the world. You know, the rankings that come out every year of the nation's and the world's best beaches are out. And I like to every couple of years open up the phones, hear from listeners your favorite beach you've seen anywhere in the country or around the world. But I'm going to need your calls for us to sustain it, so I'm not just sitting here twiddling my thumbs with dead air. So that's later this hour. I look forward to your participation. Think about the beautiful beach that you want to share with your fellow KPCC Air Talk listeners. Last hour, we were talking in our politics segment about a video of Nancy Pelosi from an interview that she did that was edited in such a way that all of her ums and uhs and corrections that she made were all spliced together, giving the impression that she wasn't very coherent in the interview. It was real. It just happened to be edited. We turn our attention now to a video that isn't real. It's what's described as a deep fake. It's an edited video of Nancy Pelosi in which her speaking was slowed down considerably to give the impression that she was intoxicated. We're going to play you back to back the unaltered audio that you can hear. And we're going to have right after that, you will hear the distorted one in which it slowed down about 25%. The Guardian put the same clip from both videos on one after the other. So again, we start with the unedited clip, then you'll hear the fake one.
We thought we had some level of agreement, but you never know with this president of the United States. So that's what happened this morning. It was very, very, very strange. And we thought we had some level of agreement, but you never know with this president of the United States. So that's what happened this morning. It was very, very, very strange.
So you hear the pacing difference, the impression very different that it gives of the House Speaker and her speaking during that Center for American Progress Ideas conference that was pulled from. Now, the altered video was posted on Facebook and was widely shared, about 2.5 million views. Facebook did not take it down. There were calls from many that Facebook should delete it because it gave a faulty impression about the condition of the House Speaker during that conversation. With us, a pair of media analysts to talk about whether Facebook should have kept that up or not. We begin with Kelly McBride, Senior Vice President, Chair for the Center for Ethics and Leadership at the Poynter Institute. Kelly, always good to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So does Facebook, in your view, have a responsibility to take it down when they've been alerted that something like this is an altered video?
Well, Facebook has a responsibility to do something. The problem is that Facebook has not created a clear set of standards for what to do about videos like this. Facebook will take down videos that are promoting violence, that are going to result in someone being harmed, and they will take down videos that are clearly faked. In your intro, you called this a deep fake, and it's not quite a deep fake, because a deep fake would be a video where I took a bunch of videos of Nancy Pelosi, and then I had her saying something that she never really said, which we have technology to do, although it's not sophisticated enough right now to fool most people. But it's pretty darn close.
So this is a shallow fake.
This is shallow fake. This is a doctored video, right? This video was slowed down, and the impression that the viewer gets when the video is slowed down is dramatically altered from the standard version of the video. So right now Facebook did what its policies allow it to do, which is to alert users who are sharing the video and viewing the video that it has been determined by fact checkers that this video is altered. There's all sorts of theories about what that does to the information ecosystem. People talk about the boomerang effect, and if you take a video down, it makes people more likely to seek it out. People talk about how people who are sharing the video don't care that it's faked because they're doing so because they want to make a political statement or because they agree with certain political philosophies. In this case, I think Facebook did what it could do based on its existing policies. Google and YouTube took the video down. Twitter did not take the video down. So you can kind of see the big Silicon Valley tech companies falling on different sides of that dividing line. And if Facebook wanted to take the video down, if they wanted to move to a world where they would remove video that has a harmful effect on a democracy, they would have to create a completely different set of shared values about what the democratic value of a particular piece of information is. Yeah, and they are not at all ready to do that.
Well, good luck getting Americans to agree on that, let alone, you know, a company to weigh in on that issue. Kelly McBride, Poynter Institute Center for Ethics and Leadership, also with us. DePauw University in Indiana, Professor of Communication Jeffrey McCall, columnist for The Hill and author of Viewer Discretion Advised: Taking Control of Mass Media Influences. Professor McCall, it's always a pleasure. Do you think Facebook has a responsibility to do more with this?
No, I don't know necessarily that they should. I mean, one of the questions, first off, is whether Facebook should referee or get into the umpiring game at all. And one thing to think about, as Kelly McBride said, is that they're not really set up for that function. They were not set up for that function originally, and they're not now either. And it's kind of like telling General Motors to get more involved in controlling drunk driving on the highways. But even if we decided to say, well, they should be starting to referee and umpire, the question is, can they do this policing fairly? And I think there are a lot of folks out there who would question what their standards are and whether they could do this fairly. And, you know, and who's to say that Facebook is so all-knowing that they should be making decisions as to what people want to put out there into the rhetorical sphere. Now, of course, the rhetorical sphere has all kinds of crazy stuff out there, some that is accurate and some that is clearly not accurate. But, you know, we created a First Amendment, the founders did, with the idea that the public at some point could figure it out and they had to fend for themselves.
Well, and where would you draw the line? I guess, so let's say someone puts out a video of President Trump with, you know, horns coming out of his head and fire blazing out of his hair. And, you know, I mean, where do you draw the line at something that is considered to be satirical or pointed in political commentary or misleading to give a faulty impression? Where, you know, that's a lot of gray area, isn't it?
There's a lot of gray area there. And you talked about the extreme example of President Trump, of course, and we would say, oh, that's pretty outside the bounds. But there's stuff out there on the internet right now that has all kinds of crazy stuff about Trump. And, you know, let's face it, the people who put together this slowed down video of Speaker Pelosi speaking, they are trying to make a political statement. And we might not like that political statement, and it might be done unfairly, and it might be done with ill intent. But on the other hand, these are public figures. These are people operating in the public sphere. They have big platforms with which to defend themselves. And public figures who enter the public fray need to recognize it's a bare-knuckled world out there. And one thing I'd like to point out, too, is in a sense that we're discussing this and that people around the nation now know that that is an altered video, kind of tells me that the marketplace worked in this regard, that they put out that altered video. Some people watched it. A lot of people watched it out of anger, knowing that it was deceptive. And some people don't like Speaker Pelosi anyway, and they're going to believe that maybe she's incoherent. But in a sense, the marketplace worked because it was determined to be inaccurate and or faked or, and deep faked or moderate faked, whatever.
Yeah.
People now know that it was faked, and the organization that did that should be, you know, held accountable for that, and people should consider the source now for the future.
Kelly McBride, where would you try and draw that line, particularly, you know, as I mentioned, you can have satirical or political pointedness or, you know, how isn't a lot of this in the eye of the beholder?
Sure, and Facebook can be the beholder. I mean, it's not like Facebook is a government agency. Facebook is a private company that can make its own rules. It is a walled garden, and the users can leave it if they don't like the rules that they create. And so Facebook could easily create, that's not accurate. It would be difficult, but it is possible to create a more stringent set of guidelines for what type of content is disallowed. Would I want them to disallow satire? No, I don't think that that's what we're talking about. But when we're talking about information that has been deliberately, that is deliberately inaccurate with an intent to deceive, I think that you might be able to create some criteria about how you would know that and whether that's actually true, and then take an action to take that down.
I'd love to hear from listeners. First of all, do you think that Facebook should be in that position of being the arbiter of what is something that is faked and misleading and should be removed or not? And if you think they should, how would you go about it? How would you find some way of objectively making that determination? 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Kelly, we know Facebook was looking at, you know, panels to do assessment of material that's posted on Facebook and the like. Was this kind of video something that was mentioned as a part of that?
Sure. And what they do is they use about 50 fact-checking organizations around the world. And those fact-checking organizations, they farm out content to those independent organizations. And those organizations determine if something is accurate or not. And if it's determined to be inaccurate, Facebook adds material to the content so that the users know that a fact checker has determined that it's inaccurate. They could use that same procedure for figuring out which videos to take down.
I'm guessing, Jeff McCall, you wouldn't necessarily trust that fact checking process to be objective.
Well, that's the $64,000 question. I'm glad that Facebook, you know, farms this out. I'm glad they have a fact checking process in place. But one of the questions is, you know, can they possibly manage the enormity of this challenge? I mean, think of all the content that would need to be managed out there. And one of the questions is, are they managing just the content of, like, the political sphere? Or are they managing the content of interpersonal interactions on Facebook? Are they managing, you know, even sports criticism? Are they managing all kinds of things that might be unfair? And, you know, let's face it. There are all kinds of people out there who are going to engage in exaggeration or omission. And Kelly mentioned about, you know, is the content designed with the intent to deceive? Well, you could make a case that even late night comedians design their jokes with the intent to deceive or exaggerate. Now, I mean, I'm not comparing, you know, Stephen Colbert, you know, to this deep fake video that was prepared. But on the other hand, Stephen Colbert certainly makes exaggeration on all kinds of political issues that are designed to make a rhetorical point. And I guess my sense here is that the enormity of this task for Facebook to insert itself into trying to referee is almost just too much. And I think it also perhaps misleads news consumers and Facebook users out there to think that somebody out there is watching out for them, and it gives a false sense to these news consumers, oh, if it's false or faked or whatever, Facebook will watch out for us. And I guess my sense is we need to be telling audiences, do your own accuracy testing and beware for yourself and look for the crazy stuff that's out there and use your own gumption at a certain point and don't rely necessarily on Facebook.
Yeah, so that if someone saw this doctored video of Nancy Pelosi and thought, wow, that, you know, really shows her seemingly not well, I'm going to check on this, do a little research, see if that's an accurate video.
It'd be a great study for a master's thesis. Some graduate student, you know, should take this video and show it to some people who've never seen it before and just say, assess this video for us. And my guess is, your average sensible person could look at that video and say, there is something that has been done to this. We know that this is not how the speaker normally speaks. And, you know, Speaker Pelosi does have some, you know, interesting speaking mannerisms, but we know she doesn't speak that slowly.
I want to thank you both for weighing in with your thoughts on it. Jeffrey McCall, DePauw University Professor of Communication, Kelly McBride of the Poynter Institute Center for Ethics and Leadership. She chairs the center and is the Senior Vice President of Poynter. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Trump administration sanctions against the electronics company Huawei have begun to bite, even though it's unclear how sweeping they are. We're going to talk about the Beijing-based tech giant coming up. It'll be a primer on the company in just 1 minute. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. A couple weeks ago, the U.S. Commerce Department placed the Chinese-based tech powerhouse Huawei on its so-called entity list. That effectively bars U.S. firms from selling it technology without government approval. Google said it would continue to support existing Huawei smartphones, but future devices won't have the flagship apps and services, including Maps, Gmail, and Google Search. Only basic services would be available. That's going to make Huawei phones much less desirable. The company is the world's leading provider of networking equipment, but it relies on U.S. components, including computer chips. And about a third of the company's suppliers are American. We thought we'd take a step back and look at the rise of the company, what its links are to the Chinese government, and how it's going to exist going forward if Google doesn't cooperate with running its apps on new Huawei phones. With us to talk about the company is David Cloud, LA Times reporter who covers national security. David, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So, first of all, what has been the intelligence community's, national security community's view of Huawei over the recent years?
Well, going back a number of years, actually, back into the Bush administration, U.S. intelligence agencies have worried about Huawei gear getting into U.S. telecom networks. They've worried about Huawei gear getting into allies' telecom networks in Europe and Asia. The main concern is, at least their argument is, that Huawei is a Chinese company, has some past links and maybe some existing links with the Chinese government. And if you allow them to infiltrate, you know, their gear, sell gear and switches and other components, that will give the Chinese an opportunity to steal data and intercept communications. And this is a long-running concern by the intel community. Only under the Trump administration has it really come to the fore, and as part of sort of the Trump's wide-ranging sort of crackdown on China and attempts to constrain China. So it's become a much more prominent issue.
And is the move toward the next generation 5G for wireless, is that also bringing this to a head?
It is, yeah. I mean, the concern that you hear from U.S. officials in Washington is once we move to 5G, you know, telecom networks will be much more important and will be software based and will have much more of a role in daily life, from self-driving cars to, you know, many aspects of daily life. And that if you allow Huawei to be in telecom networks, that again, that raises the vulnerability of those networks and could allow some actor, presumably the Chinese government, if it ever came to that, to selectively shut off things like utilities or shut off, you know, make cars drive erratically, all sorts of things you hear from U.S. officials about the concerns. And it should be said that those concerns are somewhat theoretical, obviously, and that the U.S. has not put forward any very persuasive evidence that Huawei has those kinds of links to the Chinese government. They sort of ask you to take their word for it. But, you know, serious people say that the issue in theory exists.
Well, and I think the assumption of many here in the United States is you don't become that big and successful a Chinese company without the Chinese government being heavily involved.
Well, that may be an assumption. I mean, the history of Huawei is that it started quite small in 1987 by a guy named Ren Zhengfei, and you know, he began selling, you know, small components in China and gradually worked his way up. He did get loans from the Chinese government. There was some support, as companies around the world get loans, you know, from their government, and then gradually worked overseas and was a low-cost producer of telecom gear, which allowed him to you know, vacuum up a lot of market share, and it has grown into the global leader in telecom equipment. So, you know, it's not entirely clear that it's not clear at all, in fact, that's, you know, simply the result of having some support from the Chinese government. But that support certainly exists.
We're talking with Los Angeles Times national security reporter David Cloud. David, also on 5G, where do U.S. telecom companies and research entities stand versus what's happening in China and with Huawei on 5G? Is China more advanced?
They could be. I mean, U.S. telecom companies are just rolling out the first versions of 5G in very limited numbers, and you know the big concern here is that that essentially that China would be allowed to sort of dominate that trade given Huawei's global dominance, and one of the aims of the Trump administration or some in the Trump administration is to create, you know, essentially a wall with China so that U.S., which doesn't have a lot of telecom gear producers right now, in fact, it has almost none, it produces components but not the switches and routers themselves, so that the U.S. would begin producing those or buying them from Europe and produce it and have its own 5G system.
We're talking with David Cloud, L.A. Times, also with us from USC's U.S.-China Institute, director of the Institute, Clayton Duby. Clayton, good to have you with us again.
Good to be with you.
What is the potential effect on American tech and 5G with this Huawei ban?
Well, it's hard. I'm not a tech guy, so I would have difficulty saying exactly what the ramifications are, except that I think a couple of the points that David made merit amplification. And the first is that 5G is coming. There's no question about that. It exists in a couple of American cities. But the full rollout means the integration of all kinds of things into a networked environment. And while Huawei is one of the three or four dominant players in terms of the networking aspect of it, all of this is driven by, primarily by, American technology. So to process the information that crosses that network, you still need chips from Intel, you need chips from a British company, from ARM, and that sort of thing to process this. And so that's why this is so complicated, that we're talking now about technical innovation and technical integration that is unprecedented.
We're talking with Clayton Duby, USC's U.S.-China Institute. Clayton, what about the Chinese government's potential involvement in Huawei? You've looked at a lot of different Chinese companies. Is it really possible for a company in that country to become this large and to be fully independent from its government?
Well, first of all, it's illegal for a Chinese company or a Chinese citizen to deny a request of the Chinese government to offer it assistance. And so the short answer is no. In the future and at present, it is not possible to be fully independent. On the other hand, it's important to keep in mind that Huawei's rise has coincided with this telecommunications revolution, where China went from being a place where very few people had access to phones to now you're looking at a billion people with phones. And so the opportunities just within China were immense. And Huawei, as a Chinese company, got favored treatment. And the biggest purchasers of that equipment are three state-owned companies. And so they would be directed by the government to favor, of course, national producers. At the beginning, they had to bring in Cisco, they had to bring in other networking companies, but today you can suffice with Huawei gear. Again, with the proviso that the phones in, or the computer chips in the phones and elsewhere in the network are largely produced by foreign companies.
So what is your assessment of the degree of vulnerability if Huawei was allowed to move forward with networking equipment installations in the United States, do you think it would leave the U.S. vulnerable?
Well, this is something, of course, that the intelligence community has been focused on. And the basic idea that that drives most of their thinking is that you're only as strong as your weakest link. And so if some portion of the network is compromised, if, for example, you have somebody with sensitive information who is accessing the net via a hacked cell phone or via a home computer that may have also been penetrated, then you have potential leakage. And, of course, everybody is aware that the Chinese have been very successful, that Chinese entities, including the Chinese state, have been very successful at penetrating American networks to acquire intellectual property, in some cases for military application, in other cases for commercial application. And, of course, it's not just American companies. The Canadian telecom giant that was put into bankruptcy in part because of hacking, Nortel, was also vulnerable to this.
Clayton Duby with us on Air Talk from the University of Southern California's U.S.-China Institute. Also with us from the Kissinger Institute on China and the U.S. at the Wilson Center, Program Assistant Ray Zong. Ray, how have other countries dealt with their concerns about Huawei?
So other countries are independently assessing the vulnerabilities that allowing Huawei to supply 5G infrastructure would introduce to their respective systems. So in looking at the timeline of how these assessments have gone on, Australia is actually one of the earliest states that introduced a ban. In more recent months, we've also seen the UK release an assessment that they also released in 2018 saying that Huawei cannot supply core parts, but that they also weren't banning Huawei absolutely. So in a lot of these states which have security alliances with the United States, they've been looking for the United States to take a more proactive approach in intelligence sharing and really making sure that strategic partners are aware of the details of vulnerabilities of using Huawei equipment.
And one of the appeals of Huawei is that it's comparatively cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have to balance that with the vulnerability.
Right. The question for a lot of states that are looking to upgrade or maintain infrastructure equipment is that they run into the problem where Huawei is the only bidder on the projects that they're looking to complete. So Mexico has faced this problem, Central America states, Latin American states, African states, they're all looking to find a contractor to build the equipment. And Huawei's competitors, the European firms, Nokia and Ericsson, they might not provide a price or a contract that is agreeable. And so Huawei, whether it's being able to bid cheaply because of Chinese state support or whether they're bidding cheaply as a business strategy, it's able to get its foot in the door in that way.
Do you have a sense of with the U.S. action limiting Huawei, is that potentially going to set back the company so that it's not going to be able to expand as dramatically?
I think that a lot of states are making the decisions individually. As I mentioned before, a lot of strategic partners with the United States were looking for additional answers in terms of intelligence sharing, and they're assessing these individually. But in states, particularly ones involved in China's Belt and Road Initiative projects that are on the receiving end of development-related loans, they might be looking at different strategic goals in terms of, well, I know there are security risks, but I'm going to decide to try to upgrade my telecommunications infrastructure anyway, or I don't have anything that is necessarily valuable in case of a cybersecurity issue. And so different states are making decisions more or less on their own.
Ray, thank you very much. That's Ray Zhang joining us from the Kissinger Institute on China and the U.S. at the Wilson Center. Also with us, Clayton Duby, USC's U.S.-China Institute, which he directs, and David Cloud, L.A. Times national security reporter. Coming up, we open up the phones for you to share, as you know, it's now the unofficial start of summer. We're out of Memorial Day weekend. Your favorite beach anywhere in the world. Doesn't have to be here in Southern California, or that's great. Could be somewhere on the Gulf Coast, the Atlantic Coast, or it could be abroad, maybe the south of France. Maybe it's a beach in Rio de Janeiro. 866-893-KPECC. 866-893-5722. It's just you and me. We talk about the best beaches around the world. The best beach survey is out of the U.S. as well as internationally. 866-893-5722. Back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdy's. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Summer has unofficially started. It may not technically be the season, but once you come out of Memorial Day weekend, it's on. And that means people looking to go to the beach over the next 3 months. My question for you is, where is your favorite beach? It could be here in Southern California, across the country, or literally around the world. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Dr. Beach, as he is known, Stephen Leatherman, who's a coastal scientist and professor at Florida International University, has been putting together a list of the best beaches since 1991. Now, Professor Leatherman, Dr. Beach, uses 50 criteria to evaluate beaches. He looks at water cleanliness, the safety of the beach, how well is its environment managed, are the facilities kept up, aesthetics of beauty, water quality, all these different things are looked at. And he comes up with a list of his top 10 U.S. beaches. This year, Dr. Beach's number one is on the island of Oahu in Hawaii. It's Kailua Beach Park, which, if you've ever been there, is absolutely gorgeous. I understand why he would choose it for his top beach. But there are so many other gorgeous beaches, and I'd like to have you share with your fellow listeners your favorite and why. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Jazz Chick writes on the page, one of my favorites, it's in Cambria, Moonstone Beach. Absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous beach where you can just walk on that boardwalk along the beach for miles. Absolutely beautiful. And there are parts of it you can look up and see Hearst Castle off in the distance. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Also up on the Central Coast, Coast, Norma has Cayucas is her favorite, not for swimming, but she's a big fan of that. Plus, it's a great historic small beach town. When you drive into Cayucas, it feels like you've gone back to a beach town in 1950s California. It's just got an incredible vibe. 866-893-KPECC. The appropriately named Summer in Buena Park. Summer, your favorite beach?
My favorite beach is in Esperance, Western Australia. My husband's from Western Australia, and we used to go all around the world. We didn't meet in Australia. We used to go all around the world, and he's like, this is a really pretty beach, but it's not Esperance pretty. And I would roll my eyes. And then I moved to Australia and saw this beach, and it is that gorgeous.
So describe what makes it so beautiful.
It's really, really remote. It's about an eight-hour drive from Perth, which is the capital of Western Australia. So it's really remote. Beautiful, fine-grained white sand, blue water, and the best part is there will be kangaroos just hanging out on the beach.
Wow, that's got to be a scene. So when you lived in Australia, despite the drive, did you go there regularly or just hit it a couple of times?
We did. My husband, he grew up on a farm out there, so we went out to go see his family and would go out to Esperance to go fishing. You can just drive straight onto the beach and fish right there. You'll see, like, manta rays.
Wow.
And like I said, like, you'll see kangaroos just lounging on the beach.
Summer, thank you so much. You live back here in Southern California now?
I do now, yeah.
All right, thanks. So she lived in Australia, where her husband is from, Esperance Beach, the state of Western Australia, 866-893. KPCC Sandy in Woodland Hills says her favorites are the beaches in Tel Aviv, beautiful beaches and beautiful people. Sandy, thank you for that. Karen in Brentwood votes for Good Harbor Beach in Massachusetts, says it is just simply beautiful. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Pippi says any beach in Grand Cayman, really great diving too. Let's see, we have Maricela in Pasadena, your favorite beach.
Absolutely, it's in Playa del Carmen. It's turquoise clear, beautiful. The weather is wonderful. The people are so warm and loving. You guys will absolutely love it. We spent our honeymoon there.
That sounds great. Maricela, Playa del Carmen, that's your favorite beach. And what's the best way to get there?
Airplane.
Okay, and you fly into the airport on the Yucatan that's there, Cancun. Is that where you fly in?
Yes.
Okay, all right, Maricela, thanks so much. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. John, downtown Los Angeles, you've got an East Coast beach, your favorite. Where is it?
Yes, I do. Hilton Head Island. Off the coast, right off the coast of South Carolina. You take the 17 and get on the Cross Island Express. And when you hit the beach, make sure you hit it right before the sun go down, because right when the sun go down, it's like it's just you and God. I mean, you look up, you see every constellation. You see it's amazing.
Hilton Head Island off the South Carolina coast. And I've not been there, but I know that's a big tourist destination, right? So are you able to get away from all the crowds there to enjoy the sunset you're describing and enjoy it in peace?
Actually, it is a big area, but most people, when they go to party, they go to Myrtle Beach, which is just north.
Okay. All right.
There is more private and more quiet, and it's just
John, I hear it. It's like you're transported back there in your mind to that experience. Thank you so much. That's great. Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. John in downtown Los Angeles. We're asking for your favorite beach. Could be here in the U.S., here in Southern California, or it could be around the world. 866-893-KPCC. Let's hear about another international beach before we break. Robert in Santa Monica, your favorite.
My favorite beach is Sperlonga in Italy, which is about halfway between Rome and Naples on the Mediterranean coast.
And what makes it so gorgeous?
Well, what makes it so wonderful is the entire package. My favorite beach is not necessarily pegged to the natural beauty, which it is gorgeous, but it's also the spectacular food, the spectacular water, the spectacular town to visit. It's got the full package, and it's great for families. It's got a beach, sandy beach, which is rare on the Mediterranean side, so you've got it all.
And how often have you visited Sperlonga Beach?
I have been going about more than 10 years every summer. And the other thing I'd add is I now live in Santa Monica, and I have to say I'm not a big fan of the ocean. I much prefer the Mediterranean Sea. It's just much more accessible for those of us who don't surf or know how to fight waves.
Yeah, Robert, I appreciate it. So you go every summer. How long do you spend when you go?
We have stayed for as long as a month, and as short as a week. But I, in those 15 years, I lived in Italy for 10 of those years.
Okay.
So it was a two-hour drive.
Oh, nice. So it was local. Robert, thanks so much. 866-893-KPCC. Sperlonga Beach between Rome and Naples. By far Robert's favorite, and he lives in Santa Monica. We have more international beaches, including another East Coast beach we're going to hear about from listeners. Your favorite beaches, this in light of Dr. Beach, as he's known, professor at Florida International University, putting out his annual list. I'll also tell you some of his other picks for best U.S. beaches. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. It's the unofficial start of summer as we're immediately post-Memorial Day. Dr. Beach, as he's known, a professor at Florida International University, Stephen Leatherman's, put out his list of the top 10 U.S. beaches. He's done it every year since 1991. He has 50 criteria for making the determination. Oahu's Kailua Beach Park is his number one pick. That followed by Ocracoke Lifeguarded Beach at the Outer Banks of North Carolina. I've actually seen that beach, and it is absolutely gorgeous. On the Florida Panhandle, Grayton Beach State Park is his number three. Cooper's Beach in Southampton in New York is his number four. There's a second Oahu beach that's included. Duke Kahanamaku Beach on Oahu is his number five. Cape Cod's Coast Guard Beach in Massachusetts, number six. Kaladesi Island State Park in Dunedin, Clearwater, Florida, number seven. Hapuna Beach State Park, that's a gorgeous one, on the Big Island of Hawaii. And right here in Southern California, we come in at number nine, Coronado Beach in San Diego, home of the gorgeous Hotel Del. That is number nine. And Beachwalker Park in South Carolina on, I'm not sure if it's Kiowa or Kiowa Island, South Carolina, comes in at number 10. All right, let's talk with Seth in Studio City. Seth, you've got a U.S. beach, your favorite. Where is it?
I do, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Spring Lake, New Jersey, which is next to Belmar, which is the town where Jersey Shore was filmed. It's completely the opposite. It's pristine and super quiet. There's no radio playing allowed on the beach. It's this old 19th century Victorian home, Victorian town, filled with these beautiful mansions from that were built in the late 19th century. It's gorgeous and pristine. But the very interesting thing about it, too, is that it's actually the site of the four lethal shark attacks that inspired the story Jaws, two of which were actually at Spring Lake, and two were in towns just nearby.
Wow. And does Spring Lake get a lot of tourists, or do they avoid it because it is kind of low-key quiet?
It's very low-key, and it's kind of a best-kept secret about New Jersey, one of the best-kept secrets in New Jersey. And I'm hoping I haven't left the cat out of the bag, but it's absolutely gorgeous, and if people ever get a chance to check it out, I strongly recommend it.
Seth, hey, great, because I think people wouldn't intuitively think of the Jersey Shore as a place, you know, specifically go just for the great, you know, quiet beach experience. Seth, thanks so much. 866-893-KPCC. One of my favorites, Gale in Claremont. You can't even describe this place you're going to talk about in words. It's incredible.
Yes, it's called a Moody Beach, and it's really more of a bay, I would say. It's in Santorini, Greece, and you walk down several hundred steps, and you can jump off of a concrete pier into the bay, and if you lay on your back and float, you can just look up and see how Santorini was created as an exploded volcano.
Yeah, it is. The geology gives it away so incredibly. And remember how blue the water is there? It's just deep blue.
Unbelievably amazing. You know, just to float on your back and look up at this volcano, it's a marvelous experience. And the other fun thing is that you don't have to take all those steps back up. you can just, you know, hire a donkey, which is kind of their taxi service, and you can take a donkey right back up to the top. It's just a marvelous experience.
Gail, thank you so much. Amudi Bay, Santorini, Greece, gorgeous island. Rob in Long Beach, real quickly, your pick for best beach.
Fort Cochin, which is in southern India in the state of Kerala. And essentially, it's kind of like a combination of Laguna Beach and Venice Beach, but it's on the Arabian Sea, so the water's very warm. And essentially, half to two-thirds of the people on the beach are Muslim, so it's a bunch of families in burqas having a wonderful beach day, which was a very interesting experience.
That must have taken a moment to sort of sort through mentally, seeing that on a beach so different than here.
And what's weird is it wasn't. Everyone was having a great time. It was not any different than going to the beach here, just a lot more clothes.
Much more covered, yeah. Rob, hey, thanks so much. Fort, how do you pronounce it again?
Fort Cochin.
Cochin.
Gee.
All right.
In southern India. Yep.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate it. Let's talk with Giselle in Hawthorne. Where's your favorite beach?
So my favorite beach is an island in the Philippines called Boracay. It's a small island in central Philippines. And I don't know if you know, Larry, but the Philippines is made out of 7,107 islands. So there's a lot of islands.
A lot of beaches.
One of the most beautiful, yeah.
That sounds great. And so white sands, good water quality in the Philippines beaches?
You know, it depends on the tourists that come. I was born, got married in Boracay. That's how beautiful it is. But the entire island of Boracay is only 4 miles. So it's very small, but it makes for such a great experience because it's the Filipino people and their hospitality that makes it the best beach in the world.
Yeah, very, very known for that, Giselle. Thank you so much, Giselle in Hawthorne. Our time's limited, so I'm going to read some of the other suggestions. In Big Sur, Andrew Molara State Park, Jane in Solano Beach, who also lives at a very nice beach, says most people drive by Molara State Park on Highway 1, but you have to cross a small creek, then you have to hike out to the beach, and no one is there, Jane says. That sounds absolutely wonderful. In Bali, Indonesia, Dana, City of Industry, says Kuta Beach, Bali. Was working in the Navy, had the opportunity to go multiple times. No place in Bali without a nice beach, Dana says. Yeah, I bet that's true. And Chris in Mission Viejo says Ilunda on the island of Crete in Greece is his favorite. Went on their honeymoon, said it was just spectacular. Again, you can share your favorite beach around the world on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. Have a wonderful rest of your day. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next AirTalk.